Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy and John Russell. Brian Lynn tells us about fish learning to drive in this week's science report. We close with the next part of The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
Civil rights movement hero Martin Luther King Jr. is honored with a holiday on the third Monday in January. He would have been 93 years old this month, but was murdered in 1968 at the age of 39. King led a movement of nonviolent, peaceful protests to fight racial injustice in the United States. The first example of this movement began in December of 1955. It was the Montgomery bus boycott in the southern state of Alabama. Many southern cities, including Montgomery, practiced racial segregation, or the separation of black and white Americans in public places. When using public transportation such as buses, the law in Montgomery stated that blacks must enter from the back door, and the first 10 rows of seats were for whites only. On December 1st in 1955, a black woman, Rosa Parks, was riding a bus on her way home from work. She refused to give her seat to a white man and was arrested. At the time, King was a 26-year-old clergyman at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery. In an interview with the British Broadcasting Corporation in 1961, he explained what happened next.
More than 99% of the Negro people of Montgomery rose up with righteous indignation, I would say, and this led to the bus boycott. They asked me to serve as a spokesman, and then from this time, I found myself in a leadership position in the civil rights struggle.
In Montgomery, King and others organized a one-day boycott of city buses on December 5th. 3 days later, under the leadership of King and others, a list of demands was presented to city officials. The demands included fair seating for all and courteous treatment by bus operators. The demands were not met. City officials and white opponents tried to defeat the boycott. Blacks organized and helped one another to meet transportation needs. Many blacks walked or rode bikes to where they needed to go. King's home was bombed in early 1956. He and his family were not hurt. That same year, King was arrested and found guilty of interfering with a business. Blacks in Montgomery stayed off city buses through 1956. More than a year and a half after the boycott began, on the 20th of December in 1956, the Supreme Court agreed with a lower court decision that public bus segregation is not legal. King's role in the bus boycott won international attention. His example of mass, nonviolent protest was a model for fighting injustice in the United States for decades to come. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Smart guns, guns that can only be fired by certain users, might become available to U.S. buyers after more than 20 years of debate. This debate has included questions about reliability and concerns that smart guns will lead to a new wave of government rules. The company Lodestar Works recently showed its 9mm smart handgun to investors in Boise, Idaho. And a company based in Kansas, Smart Guns LLC, said law enforcement agents are testing its product, a similar but simpler model. Both companies hope to have a product available for American buyers this year. Lodestar co-founder Gareth Glazer said he has heard too many stories about children shot while playing with an unattended gun. Smart guns could stop such tragedies by using technology that confirms a user's identity and disables the gun should anyone else try to fire it. Supporters of the technology say it could reduce suicides and make lost or stolen guns useless. In addition, it could offer protection for police officers and jail guards who risk having their own weapons used against them. But earlier attempts to develop smart guns have failed. Smith & Wesson promised in 1999 to support smart guns and other measures in an agreement with the U.S. government. As a result, the National Rifle Association, a gun rights group, supported a boycott that led to a drop in sales. And in 2014, German company Armatex put a smart handgun on the market. But it was withdrawn after hackers discovered a way to block the gun's radio signals. They could also fire the gun using magnets when it should have been blocked from firing. Most early smart gun test models used either fingerprint or radio technology to unlock the gun. Lodestar uses both a fingerprint reader and a communication device activated by a phone app. It also permits the entry of a personal identification number, or PIN. The gun can permit more than one user. Smart guns would not say which law enforcement agencies are testing its weapons, which are secured by radio identification. Critics have argued that smart guns are too risky for a person or police officer to use during a crisis. The National Shooting Sports Foundation, NSSF, the firearms industry trade group, says it does not oppose smart guns as long as the government does not make laws that require their sale. Lawrence Keene is a vice president of the NSSF. Keene said, "If I had a nickel for every time in my career I heard somebody say they're about to bring us a so-called smart gun on the market, I'd probably be retired now." The arrival of smart guns on the market could lead to legal changes. For example, a 2019 New Jersey law requires all gun shops in the state to offer smart guns after they become available. The 2019 law replaced a 2002 law that would have banned the sale of any handgun except for smart guns. Scott Bach of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs said, "The other side tipped their hand because they used smart guns to ban everything that's not a smart gun. It woke gun owners up." To tip one's hand means to show a plan of action at a time that is too early. The New Jersey state law has raised the anger of defenders of the Second Amendment. This amendment to the U.S. Constitution says, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." I'm John Russell.
Israeli researchers say they have successfully taught a goldfish to drive a small robotic car. The team said the fish showed its ability to navigate toward a target in order to receive a food reward. For the experiment, the researchers built what they called a fish-operated vehicle, FOV. The main part of the vehicle was a fish tank attached to a moving machine with four motorized wheels. Attached to the top was a system used to follow all movements of the fish and vehicle. The system was operated by LIDAR, a technology that uses light lasers to map environments and measure distances. When the system observed that the fish was up against the side of the glass while facing forward, it would move the vehicle forward in that direction. The researchers said that over time, the fish learned that putting itself in these positions would move the FOV in those directions. In this way, the fish was able to drive the vehicle. A team at Israel's Ben-Gurion University of the Negev carried out the research. Results of the experiment were recently reported in the publication Behavioral Brain Research. Researcher Shachar Givon told the Reuters news agency it was surprising how quickly the fish learned to drive the vehicle. "They're confused at first. They don't know what's going on," he said. "But they're very quick to realize that there is a correlation between their movement and the movement of the machine that they're in." The team used six different goldfish in the study. Each fish took part in about 10 driving exercises. A colorful target was clearly marked on a wall opposite the tank. Each time a fish reached a target, it was rewarded with food. The researchers said the fish were able to navigate to the target even if something happened to temporarily take them off the path. And they said the fish were not fooled by false targets placed by the team. Researcher Ronan Segev said some of the fish proved to be excellent drivers. Others, he said, showed that while they could control the vehicle, they were not very good at driving it. The team reported that their experiment led to two main findings. The first was that navigational ability is universal rather than specific to the environment, researcher Givon said in a statement. Secondly, the experiment showed that goldfish have the cognitive ability to learn to perform a complex operation in an environment completely unlike the one they evolved in. Givon compared the experiment to a human first learning to ride a bicycle or drive a car. In both of those cases, the beginning can be difficult, he said. A description of the study noted that navigation is a critical ability for animal survival. Such an ability permits many kinds of creatures to find shelter, seek mates, and be successful in many kinds of behaviors. In this case, the researchers sought to find out whether the fish could use the same navigational skills they use in the water to move a vehicle traveling on land. In the end, the team found the results demonstrated that a fish is able to keep its space representation and navigation skills when put into a completely terrestrial or land-based environment. Researcher Ronan Segev said, "We humans think of ourselves as very special, and many think of fish as primitive, but this is not correct." He added that there are many other very important and very smart creatures. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. June 18, 1910, was an exciting day for Theodore Roosevelt. It was the day that the former American president returned from a long trip to Africa and Europe. Hundreds of thousands of people gathered in New York City to welcome him home. There were speeches and bands and a parade. Frank Oliver and Tony Riggs tell us about Teddy Roosevelt's trip. They also tell us how political problems hurt his friendship with President William Howard Taft.
It was the perfect end to a trip that began 3 weeks after Theodore Roosevelt completed his presidency. Most of the trip was a huge success. In Africa, Theodore Roosevelt spent months hunting wild animals. He shot many lions, elephants, and other animals. He brought all of them back and gave them to the Smithsonian Institution. After hunting in Africa, he and his wife Edith went to Europe.
The Roosevelts visited Italy and met the king and queen. They visited Vienna and met the ruler of Austria and Hungary. In Germany, they met Kaiser Wilhelm II. Kaiser Wilhelm invited the former American president to watch a big parade of German troops. He told him, "You are the first civilian who has ever joined the Kaiser in reviewing the troops of Germany." The two men were photographed shaking hands. On the back of the photograph, the Kaiser wrote, "When we shake hands, we shake the world." The Roosevelts met the kings and queens of Norway, Belgium, and the Netherlands. They met the crown princes of Sweden and Denmark. And while in England, Mr. Roosevelt served as America's official representative at the funeral of King Edward VII.
Theodore Roosevelt made a number of speeches at several universities, including Oxford and the Sorbonne. Yet all these activities did not keep him from reading newspapers and letters from home. The news troubled him. He had led the Republican Party with great success. Now, the party seemed to be falling apart. It had split into two groups. One group included conservatives who supported President William Howard Taft. The other group included progressives who opposed Taft. Theodore Roosevelt had worked hard to get William Howard Taft elected. President Taft had been in office a little more than a year. Yet, in that short time, he had broken almost completely with the progressives who had supported Roosevelt.
The split developed because progressives expected Taft to rule as Roosevelt had done, with energy and emotion. They wanted a man who could excite people with dreams of social progress. Theodore Roosevelt was such a man. William Howard Taft was not. He was a big, slow-moving man. He refused to make quick decisions. As a former judge, he depended on facts, not emotion, to make decisions. President Taft did much to carry out the reform programs Theodore Roosevelt had begun. But his methods led people to believe that he was really trying to kill the programs.
Taft wrote to Roosevelt shortly before the former president sailed for home. "I do not know if I have had harder luck than other presidents," he said. "But I do know I have succeeded far less than others. I have been trying to carry out your policies, but my method of doing so has not worked smoothly." A few weeks later, Theodore Roosevelt returned home. In a speech to those who welcomed him in New York, he said, "I am ready and willing to do my part to help solve America's problems. And these problems must be solved if this country is to reach the high level of its hopes." To President Taft, Roosevelt wrote, "I will make no speeches or say anything for 2 months, but I will keep my mind open as I keep my mouth shut."
President Taft invited Theodore Roosevelt to visit him at the White House. Roosevelt said he could not. However, he did meet with many of the progressive opponents of the president. Later, he met with Taft at the president's summer home in Massachusetts. It was not a happy meeting. The two friends were tense. By this time, Roosevelt had decided that he agreed with the progressives. He believed President Taft had turned back many of Roosevelt's policies.
Roosevelt decided it was time for him to go to the American people. He accepted an invitation to a celebration in Wyoming. He traveled west by train. He stopped in many towns and cities to make speeches. He spoke of party unity. He tried to heal the split that had weakened the Republican Party. But the policies he proposed were progressive. Conservatives refused to support them. President Taft could not understand Roosevelt's purposes. "If I only knew what he wanted," Taft said, "I would do it. But he has told me nothing. I am deeply wounded. He gives me no chance to explain my position or to learn his."
Theodore Roosevelt hoped his speaking trip would help Republican Party candidates win in the 1910 congressional elections. His efforts seemed to fail. Republicans were defeated in many states. For a year after the party's defeat in the congressional elections, Theodore Roosevelt remained silent. Then, near the end of 1911, America's political parties began to prepare for the presidential election that would be held the following year. Roosevelt was sure Taft could not be reelected. Taft had become very conservative. He had close ties to business interests. What the people wanted, thought Roosevelt, was a progressive president. What they wanted was a man like himself. So Theodore Roosevelt began to speak out again in opposition to many of the things President Taft was doing. For example, President Taft had proposed treaties with Canada, Britain, and France. Roosevelt criticized them.
Taft was troubled. He told a friend, "It is very hard to take all these blows from Roosevelt. I do not know what he is trying to do, except to make my way more difficult. It is very hard to see a close friendship going to pieces like a rope of sand." By now, it was clear to Taft that Roosevelt wanted to be the presidential candidate of the Republican Party in the election of 1912. Earlier, this would have pleased Taft. He would have been happy to leave the White House. But the situation was different now. Roosevelt had changed. Taft felt that the policies he proposed seemed too extreme. Taft decided it was his duty to oppose Roosevelt and the progressives. He would seek re-election. Taft believed he could win the Republican nomination for president. He still had the support of many party leaders.
4 months before the Republican nominating convention opened, several progressive Republican governors appealed to Roosevelt. They urged him to declare himself a candidate for president. Roosevelt, they said, was the man to lead the nation into a new era of social progress. Then Taft made a strong statement against the progressives. "They are seeking," he said, "to pull down the temple of freedom and representative government." A reporter asked Roosevelt to answer Taft's statement. Roosevelt said, "My hat is in the ring." That meant he was a candidate. Now the conflict was in the open, and Roosevelt was ready to fight.
In his speeches, Roosevelt criticized Taft bitterly. In a voice shaking with hatred, he said Taft was controlled by conservative politicians. He said Taft stood in the way of progress. He said Taft was disloyal. Taft had to answer. In one speech he said, "This tears my soul. I am here to answer an old and true friend who has made many charges. I deny all those charges. I do not want to fight Theodore Roosevelt, but I am going to fight him." After the speech, a reporter looked for the president. He found him sitting alone, his head in his hands. His eyes were filled with tears. "Roosevelt was my closest friend," Taft said.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.